to, do we have a quorum? We don't have a quorum, but we're going to start the testimony.
Thank you.
Are they here?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, we have the binders if you really want to look at the details. They're over there on the card. And we really want to get through the testimony from the Human Services today. The next few days we're going to have anybody wants to come in and comment on the bill, the general public or whoever, for 2 days. And then at the beginning of next Tuesday, we're going to do the Department of Health. And then the day after that, we'll have public testimony on the Department of Health. So I would really appreciate if you would hold your questions to the end. And we have two people from Human Services today. First of all, Ann Berry, Deputy Commissioner. Is she here?
Yes, we have.
Oh, there she is. Okay, and we now have a forum, so I'll call the meeting to order. And would somebody like to move?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes of January 31st.
Any discussion of the minutes? I don't see any. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So the minutes are approved. Commissioner Berry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I'm going to take you through two of our programs. One is state-operated services, and the second one is the Sex Offender Treatment Program. First two, those budget items that relate to state-operated services, I direct you to, I think you have two documents. One we call just the fast facts, or just the general briefing facts about the program, and that those are on pages 44 through 47. And then the budget pages, they're in a couple of different places because this initiative really does cross a number of program areas. So pages 12, 21, and 22. Let me just provide some context first. As you know, we have moved over the last 20 years from a highly institutionalized system for people who have mental illness, chemical dependency, and developmental disabilities into one where people are integrated into the community. That's not only because it's the right thing to do, but because we are required to. There are a number of federal requirements, one you might hear frequently or have heard frequently, which is around a Supreme Court decision entitled Olmstead. It's an important case for us. It's a driving case that really helps us think about the way that people who have disabilities live in the community and live with choices to live in the community, not simply mini institutional kinds of placement, but really an arrangement or an array of opportunities in the community to work, to live, to be close to family or not, depending on, again, their choices. So there's really a couple of initiatives that we're putting together here that transition people much more aggressively than we have over the last, probably the last 8 to 10 years. And it really is to move people who have serious mental health issues committed to the commissioner and are either at Anoka or at St. Peter. The courts will commit those clients to the commissioner, but we've had some difficulty moving people into the community, and there's a variety of reasons for that. There are a number of barriers to moving people into the community. Funding is a serious barrier, and that's one of the issues that we try to resolve in this governor's initiative. In addition to that, there's some question about the amount of or the capacity of community-based providers to serve people with serious mental illness, the kind of security and oversight that's required of people who are moving from a commitment and using a provisional discharge into the community. So we hope this initiative really tackles some of those more difficult issues that some of our clients face and frankly, that the counties face when trying to place people in the community. So the initiative in front of you, there's really a grouping of initiatives. The first one is on page 12 of your budget pages, which is in the continuing care program. I know Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner Coleman, went through a number of these proposals. Embedded in them was a pretty substantial proposal to move people from Anoka Regional Treatment Center and from the Security Hospital on the St. Peter campus into the community with the right kinds of supports. So right now we could move some of these people into the community, but it's very expensive to wrap services around and to build the kind of community support that is needed for all of these clients. So this is a biennial budget request for both 14 and 15 that goes out into the future. You can see the total in the next biennium is $8.1 million. Again, as I said, a pretty substantial effort on our part and on the part of counties to move people who are ready to move into the community and give them the ability to be able to do so. In addition, there are two other proposals, one on page 21 and one on page 22. We've been asked in the Senate to provide a lot more detail. We will certainly make that available to you as well. I think that's generally an overall comment we've received, but specifically to understand who we're talking about in these proposals, and I think that's important for you to understand who we're talking about. The Mental Health Transition Services Initiative on page 21 would spend an additional $2 million on people who not only have mental health and chemical health issues, but also have co-occurring medical conditions, so they may have diabetes, they may have chronic heart issues, they have needs in addition to their mental health needs. So to be able to, again, wrap around the right kinds of services to support them, we need additional supports. And this would be specifically directed at people who have other chronic health conditions in addition to mental health and chemical health issues. And then finally, there's a proposal in state-operated services that would add another $1 million, which allows us to spend on equipment. These are really one-time expenditures to help us move people into the community. So whether, a very flexible kind of fund for use by the counties, by clients, by their families, by others, to make it easier to move people into the community. We're working, as I said, on putting these all together in one place so that it's easier for you to understand the entirety of the package and who exactly we're serving. As a part of this proposal, there is also one other piece that we are certain that you will hear, if you've not already heard, some concerns raised about. But the governor would recommend and the department would recommend increasing the county share specifically for clients in the Security Hospital or in Anoka who have reached a point where they're ready to move into the community, but we have not moved them into the community. There is a county share in place already for clients who are served at the Security Hospital and at Anoka, at both of those facilities. Again, we can lay those out for you. But what this proposal does is to really realign the incentives, which is if somebody's ready to move in the community, there should be no disincentive to moving them into the community. This isn't a downsizing of either of our facilities because we have waiting lists. In the community restoration program at St. Peter, it's been in the news. We have need to move people in and out of our facilities more quickly than we're able to do, and the same is true at Anoka. For people who need the kind of care that we provide at both Security Hospital and Anoka, we need to be able to provide it there. But when clients either have been adjudicated and ready to leave those programs, we need to be able to move more swiftly and more quickly to place them in the community. What this community share does is it places a little more burden on the counties to actually move toward that placement. Over the long term, of course, if there are fewer people reaching that point in care, the county share won't change for counties. that if in fact counties and the department are successful in moving people into the community, and they don't, and people don't stay longer than they need to, then the county share, this additional county share, doesn't come into play. You can also see that we've taken that entire county share and put it right back into services. I mean, it's not for cost savings, it's not for budget alignment, it's not to try and balance the department's budgets. It's really to realign the incentives so that in fact we can more aggressively place people in the community and provide some of the costs associated with that transition. With that, Mr. Chairman, that's the overall on state operated services changes.
When these people transition out of the Anoka or the other facility, do they go back to their home county, or do they end up in the Twin Cities?
Mr. Chairman, a great question. There can be a variety of placements, but we work with the county that committed them to our facility to find the appropriate placement. So in that determination is based upon whether communities have a place for clients to move, whether provisionally discharged or discharged. We've heard a number of concerns about where these placements, you know, are, but one of the things we want to do with these resources is to spread out the capacity of services across the entire state, so no one part of the state should have to feel the burden for all of these placements. But it is, you know, to address your initial question, it is, we go back to the county of commitment to work with them on the placement. Not all people go back to their committing county.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. And we have time for some questions.
Keep it brief.
All right. Well, I have a few questions. Maybe we can take some offline. But I have three topics, and I'll just mention one that I want to talk about. There's some issues about staffing in Anoka. And apparently some of the staff here is retaliation for bringing up the topic, so I'm just bringing that as an issue to hear, which you can comment on or not. I'm curious what you're doing with Wilmer. And then I'm curious about are there counties that are not doing their due diligence in placing people? And is it a matter of their incapacity to act or not desire to act? Or maybe you can, those are my three questions. You can handle it in whatever time we have. So thanks.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler, I'll do my best to address these as quickly as I can. As far as Anoka is concerned, I hope you are know that we have made a number of staffing changes, that we're not only adding staff, we're adding security staff. Transitions were a concern of staff there, and we've addressed a number of those changes. And as far as I'm aware, as a basic principle, clearly there should never be retaliation for somebody who's raising issues around safety and client care. Whether it's at new employee orientation or when we travel around the state, we make it very clear we want people to raise issues. We want to address them before they become even bigger problems. The situation that we find ourselves in security hospital with a condition against our license is something we could have avoided. And so we need staff who work directly with clients to raise issues. If they don't, we don't know about them, we can't address them. So there should be... If there is anything that we need to know about, either the commissioner or I need to know about, please let me know. As far as Wilmer is concerned, Wilmer is now fully staffed. They are serving, I think, 15. They're a community behavioral hospital in the Wilmer area. There is legislation that requires the department to move toward closure of that facility. We are going to offer legislation this session that would continue operation of Wilmer. We think it's not only viable, we think it's needed in that particular part of the state. We will seek some sort of a special funding arrangement so that there won't have to be an appropriation. We think that they should be able to live off their receipts because, as I said, they are fully operational, fully staffed, and they have 15 of their beds have been regularly filled in the last few months. So we hope that you will authorize continued operation of Wilmer. And finally, counties, I think it's a combination of the things you raised. I think it's capacity, and it may be desire. I try not to deem intentions, but funding is probably the biggest issues that counties will say that their concern is funding and capacity to probably move as aggressively as this budget would require. We're finding out more about that capacity. We did a a request for information and had a number of people from around the state join a bidders conference. We had video from Brainerd and Duluth. There's a lot of interest in the community in building more secure capacity in the community. There's a number of barriers to doing that. We want to make sure that funding isn't one of them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
That was pretty good on covering all three questions. And I just didn't see any reference to Wilmer in the budget, so we took that as a savings early, and then both the governor changed his mind, and we says, oops, okay, fine. So we kept it alive, and so I'm glad you can do that. And the staffing thing in Anoka, Ms. Bear, you've done a great job of trying to corral that whole operations, and I know you've invested, like, thousands of hours probably in a short amount of time. But I think this is a principle. There's what you would do if you could be there, and there's what happens at the mid-level management staff, and I think there's still some issues there we can talk about. And in terms of the people going to the community, that's just a really hot topic. And I'm sorry I didn't stick with my 30% county share on sex offenders being sent to the Moose Lake, because it sounds like 25% is the break-even point. And so if that's the only lever we have to encourage counties to send people out is to start charging more money, I think we had probably better do. I was nervous about that, but if that's the lever we need to help county boards, move in the direction that things have to go, that'll be discussed much more, I'm sure. So thank you.
Commissioner, do you want to move on to the next topic?
I can, Mr. Chairman, and that is the sex offender program growth on page 47 of your fast facts and page 22 of your budget change pages. About 3 weeks ago, I was in front of the committee talking about the sex offender program and the growth in that program. It is not a forecast program, so it isn't added to the forecast that's done by management and budget. So we have to very specifically ask for the appropriation, request the appropriation that is associated with growth in those programs. You can see that by increasing the population, there's a cost associated with that. I would also add that there's some opportunity here. I know that at least two of the members are on the task force that was ordered by the court. And that there are potentially alternatives. So this budget request of $7.7 million could be used to pay for the growth in our programs that we know will happen based upon the history of these programs. But if changes are authorized by you, we could also use some of these resources to fund community-based alternatives that are secure, particularly before the commitment process takes place. So this budget item is here because we know there's growth in these programs. If nothing is done, we know that we will add, I think it's about 50 or 51 clients a year to be able to keep up with that kind of growth. We need resources. The alternative is these same funds could be used on community-based alternatives, particularly at the front end. That's the explanation, and I stand for questions if your committee has them, Mr. Chairman.
Let me ask, if we move these, these are people that obviously need to be in a security place. Do we take into account what the cost would be to the county or city in terms of increased law enforcement activities that they might require? Not that they're going to come in there and do the security directly, but they may get phone calls.
Mr. Chairman, another good question about the total costs associated with moving people into the community. Right now, as you know, we have one client who is provisionally discharged into the community, and it's the department is responsible for all the costs associated with that care. I'm not aware that local law enforcement had to add resources. They are required to do the community notification meeting, and that requires resources, but I'm not aware that there have been additional costs, but we're only talking about one client. So the potential that there would be more clients moving into the community does raise the question about costs associated with local law enforcement. All of those should be a part of this consideration before we consider alternatives. What we really need is very, very secure environments with the kind of oversight that ensures public safety.
Okay, other questions for Commissioner Berry? So why don't we move on? Is that the end of yours?
That's all of mine, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, thank you. But stick around. There might be questions at the end.
All right.
And next we have Commissioner Chuck Johnson, our Chief Financial Operating Officer. And he's going to talk about the administrative end of human services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chuck Johnson, the Chief Financial Operating Officer at DHS. I'm going to talk about the budget proposals the governor's put forward that are related to the operations part of the department. I'm actually going to talk about the first two, and then I'm going to cede the rest of the time to Jerry Kerber and Greg Gray, who will carry the ones that are related to the Office of Inspector General and the Compliance Office. The two proposals that I'm going to talk about, you can find on page 26 of the MMB budget report document. I'll talk first about the system modernization proposal, which is also the yellow sheet 51 if you're looking for additional background. The governor recommends $29.1 million in the next biennium to modernize DHS technology. Specifically, what we're proposing to do with these dollars are to replace our existing eligibility system and our existing child support system. Just a little background on DHS technology. We're the largest agency if you look in terms of IT budgets within state government. When we merged with our IT and with OET, we were spending about $120 million a year, and that was actually larger than OET's budget was at the time of that merger. A lot of the dollars and what we do is in unique business applications that support the work that we do within our programs. Most of these are required by federal law, so we really have them because we need to have them in order to get certified in order to be able to operate the federal programs. The systems are responsible for a large amount of the money that moves through human services. About of the $13 billion we spend a year, about 85 to 90% of it flows through these systems, either in payments going out to providers through the MMIS system or payments going to individuals through the child support system or through the cash and food programs. The systems are really the backbone of how we manage billions of dollars on an annual basis. But they're not just internal kind of accounting systems. They really are outward-facing systems that support fundamentally the business that we do. And, in fact, the primary users of the systems are not DHS but are the counties who administer the programs. And they're the ones that are really, on as the end users, the ones who are dealing right now with what is aging technology that needs to be upgraded and replaced in order to improve where we're going forward. This proposal is in response, in part, to a 2011 directive from the legislature that we plan with counties for modernization of our systems and that we work on, particularly on an integrated eligibility system, which is part of what we're proposing here. The two systems we're replacing, the eligibility system that we have now is called Maxis. That system supports eligibility for 14 different programs within DHS. It does eligibility for about 900,000 Minnesotans across cash, food, and health care programs. We spend about $1.3 billion through the system on cash and food benefits that are distributed through the Maxis system. And about 2,700 county workers rely on the system on a daily basis to do the work that supports the DHS programs. The second system we're proposing to replace is the PRISM system. This supports our child support program. This manages all aspects of child support enforcement, including all the accounting and the back and forth of the dollars, tracking whether the payment is being made on arrears payment or on current support, and multiple kinds of different interest that goes with that as well. About $600 million a year flows through the PRISM system. There's about 269,000 children that we serve through this system and 400,000 parents. And there's 3,700 county workers who work with this system on a daily basis to process child support and enforce child support for the people that we serve. Mr. Chair, I have a handout that I'm going to ask to have the pages pass around because I'm going to talk a little bit about how old our systems are, and I want to give you a pictorial representation of how old they are, and that's going to be in the handout. Maxis was implemented in 1992 and PRISM in 1997. So Maxis is over 20 years old and PRISM is about 15 years old. They both use a computer language that's no longer taught in any schools in the United States. It's a natural database. For those of you that know a little bit about computers, doesn't mean a lot to me, but that's what it's called. 25% of the IT staff who work on these two systems are eligible for retirement within the next couple of years. So we're also facing an aging workforce and the risk of having a workforce that has been with us for a long time, knows how to make these systems work, knows this language, and the challenge of trying to replace them when you're working with a language that isn't taught in schools, that other companies have been moving away from. We've managed to grab a few people over time. When other companies shut down their natural database systems, we could grab them in and train them up on our systems, but that is running out as well. We also have a maintenance agreement with the company that maintains this software that ends at the end of 2015, and they aren't terribly interested in continuing to maintain the software, which means that if we have to renegotiate that, we're probably not going to be in the best position financially to try to make an agreement with them for continued maintenance past 2015. So that's part of what's really driving us to try to fix these systems. The packet that you have in front of you now has screen prints from the Maxis system. This is the eligibility system on the first few pages. This is called green screen for those of you that haven't seen mainframe before, those of you that weren't around when we were first working with computers back in the 80s. Looks like DOS to some of you that remember that. Basically, workers need to know a whole lot of codes and a whole lot of four-letter acronyms that represent what panels they need to go to and then what codes they need to put into what places on those panels in order to get eligibility. And if you've talked to any staff in the counties that you represent, you'll probably hear a lot of frustration about this and how long it takes to learn and how hard it is to manage. The panel that's on page 3 is a particular interest. This is, for every eligibility case they do, they need to look at these 72 different four-letter codes here and figure out before they go through the eligibility process which of those panels they need to go to based on what they know about this family from the application. Do they have earned income? Do they have rental income? Do they have business income? Do they have other people living with them that need to go to a panel where they do that kind of work? And they need to do this all ahead in order to manage the case. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. As I said, I just wanted to give you an idea. If you look at page 5, it can take about 50 panels to go through to get eligibility for a single case.
Mr. Johnson, we had testimony, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago from somebody from Hennepin County that had to have 3 different computers on his desk at the same time in order to do this.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and that's still the case. That's not something that's changed. Although Hennepin County in particular has done a pretty good job of trying to build some software around this to do some streamlining, but still, even for those workers, they're still dealing with the same underlying systems. The last half of this handout shows you screen prints from the IBM Curum product. This is the product that's being used in the healthcare exchange, you know, that health insurance exchange. That exchange will be doing eligibility for the Medicaid population. And so it gives you a sense of what is now available in terms of technology. And you can see the basic navigation by things that we're all used to using, buttons and drop-downs and menus, the ability to have written out what it actually means instead of a four-letter code you have to memorize so you can actually read and know where you need to go next. And we think that this is the direction that we need to be moving in terms of the kind of functionality we need to make available for our systems. Particularly what we lack in our systems now is an ability for self-service, for people to apply online, for people to manage their cases, provide updates online when their situation changes, their income changes, all of which would be a service for the clients but also for the county where they would be able to have those things be automatically populated rather than having to go through paper processes they do now to verify all those items and to process changes. And also the ability to do more online transactions like online verification, such as the health insurance exchange is doing, to build that into more of our programs and leverage that opportunity to do data matching rather than doing paper processes, all of which we think will bring more efficiency. There's also a great opportunity now to leverage the work that's being done in the health insurance exchange, which will help build a real background, sort of a foundation for what we need for eligibility by taking the healthcare programs and moving those folks onto the program, and also an ability to tap into some 90% federal reimbursement that is available through the end of 2015 to the extent we're still doing some work that we can relate to healthcare as part of this project. A lot of the benefits, as I mentioned, of the new system really accrue to the counties and to the clients, not necessarily to the state. And that's where I think we'll see more efficiency is at the local operations, which will be particularly helpful as they're taking on, as they have taken on over the last few years, much larger caseloads, often without any additional new staff to support it. We also believe that the new systems can help us in terms of our internal controls and our audit tools and fraud detection by giving us more automated ways of digging in with business intelligence tools to identify where there may be fraud. A little on the fiscal aspects of this proposal, the request is for $29 million. We expect that we'll be able to match that with about $24 million in federal funds for a total of $53 million. The federal is a preliminary estimate. We're still working on that. We do have a vendor that, as part of the 2011 directive from the legislature, we've hired who's helping us with this planning. That's KPMG, a company that's done a lot of this kind of work on helping states and other organizations develop technology plans. Also, you'll see within the governor's proposal that of the $29 million, $4.2 million of that is set aside for the Medicaid share, the DHS share of the operations for the health insurance exchange. That's tracked here as part of this $29 million to support the DHS part of the exchange going forward. Also, there's a somewhat a little bit stranger aspect to the request for the modernization funding here. $18.8 million of this request is contingent. It's contingent on the receipt of federal reimbursement within the Reform 2020 initiative. Reform 2020 initiative, you recall, Assistant Commissioner Coleman came here and talked about last week, I believe, or the week before, is a long-term care initiative, which requires us to get certain waivers from the federal government. Where we sit right now is we don't have those waivers. And the Reform 2020 has some investments and some savings and some new federal revenue. And in order to make the budget balance, when we have revenue that we can't count on yet, because we don't know for sure if the feds are going to grant these waivers, we need to have contingent spending in the budget as well. And the place we identified that contingent spending is within this proposal. What this means is if we don't get the federal waivers that are anticipated under Reform 2020, that $18.8 million would not be available for this proposal, and we'd have only 29 minus 18.8 or something in the range of around $10 million to do modernization, which would allow us to get started but not to get through the full plan of trying to replace Maxis and Prism, as I just discussed. We do anticipate we'll get those waivers from the federal government, so we don't think that will be the result, but that is how the budget is structured in order to make sure we're in balance and that we're not counting on revenue that is not yet guaranteed. Mr. Chair, I have one other proposal. You want me to do both of them or take questions now?
Why don't we start with a couple of brief questions, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I'm excited and hope you get the funding so that you can update your equipment because I'm sure it's needed. So I was wondering, and what I didn't see in the proposal is that we know sometimes departments are interconnected to work that you do with the Department of Health, Education. Would this allow you to talk to other departments?
Mr. Chair and Representative Moran, I think we do some of that now. We do have interfaces with other agencies. I think in the case of child support, for example, a lot of the enforcement tools depend on interfaces with the courts, interfaces with licensing, such as the driver's license or hunting license can be suspended in child support. So a lot of that does exist. I think this would make it a lot easier because we wouldn't be dealing with interfacing old technology against old technology. Mm-hmm. I think the other opportunity that's in your question is because of the merger of all of state IT within the Minute operation, we now have a much better way to have those conversations about how we build a system and build the appropriate kind of integration layer so that we can have those better integrated systems that can talk to each other. That has been a barrier in the past, and I think we're better situated to do that now.
Thank you. One other question, Mr. Chair. Does this also include training of staff?
Mr. Chair and Representative Moran, clearly we would need to do training of staff, county staff, and our own staff as we roll the system out, and that would be part of our plan going forward.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Liebley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson. I'm also really thrilled to see this. I mean, we've needed this for a long time, clearly, and I appreciate your presentation here, which makes me feel kind of old because I remember these screens, or these kinds of screens, I should say, when I had to learn DOS when I had my first computer. But the real question I wanted to ask you, going back to the child support system, There's also spousal maintenance that's collected through the same system in a very limited number of cases, I know, but I just wanted to know if that is also being going to continue. Basically, the functions that you're doing now are going to continue with the new system. Am I right in assuming that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, you're right. Our intention is to pick up the business requirements that are within our current system and then get those into new technology.
Thank you.
I'm interested in the interaction between the exchange and yours. My understanding is the exchange is responsible for doing eligibility for medical assistance up to about age 65. Is that correct? And then after 65, for the seniors that are getting eligible for MA, is it a different system, or are you going to use the same system? It just won't be done by the exchange.
Mr. Chair, the exchange is responsible for essentially everybody who's not elderly disabled. So the elderly and the disabled are the folks who are not part of what the exchange will have responsibility for eligibility. We're working now, however, and have a goal of getting all of Medicaid eligibility, of MA eligibility, including the elderly and disabled, onto the same technology the exchange is using. And we're working kind of in parallel with the exchange on that. So that's our goal, is to get health care off of MAXIS first, all of it, both the MAGI part and the other part, as quickly as possible and into the new technology. And then this process will really take us through the cash and food programs, 4E, there's a bunch of other child care, a bunch of other programs that are still on MAXIS, and moving those into new technology as well.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, my question was whether or not, and I'm glad to hear it's going to be one continuous system for all of MA eligibility, but I'm hoping as you're working with the exchange, you're thinking about how many people with disabilities are working and will be potentially in that small group market or individual market in addition to MA, and how we're going to make that work, because as we get more and more people with disabilities working, they really are going to be part of the exchange in one way or another. And so I'm glad to hear it's an integrated system. But my second question was, are you expecting that a lot of counties are going to have to upgrade their computer hardware or other things in order to work with the new system? I know they'll all celebrate it. I celebrate your efforts. But is there a possibility of getting federal matching funds for county expenses as well?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, on the second question, we're not far enough along to know if counties are going to have to upgrade their hardware or not, but certainly those expenditures would be eligible for federal reimbursement if we get to that point. What rate it would be at, I'm not entirely sure. It would depend on how we're structuring what the computer replacement is for, but that's something we'd have to be working with the counties as we're going along. I don't have an answer for it right now. On your first question, yes, you're right. And what you pointed out is one of the many challenges of working in this new environment and trying to do in parallel the MAGI and the non-MAGI and figure out where those cross points are, where we need to have it be fully integrated, and how quickly we can do that given the tight timeline that we're working on. Part of what's behind your question, too, is that to some extent with the MA expansion, the federal law, the disability door for eligibility isn't the only door that's there for someone who might be disabled. You can be on MA and you don't have to necessarily claim a disability, and you might be working, you can still get those services. So all that needs to be figured out as we're moving through the implementation of this. But yes, we're very aware of how to play those different challenges that result from the interaction between the MAGI and the non-MAGI pieces of this.
Great. Go ahead. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, the other proposal I'd like to share with you is the County Performance Management System. That's also on page 26 of the MMB report and number 50 of your Fast Facts. Mr. Chair, the history of this project dates back to the 2009 legislative session. During that session, there was a debate around county redesign, redesigning services, redesigning the role of the county in human services. And what came out, essentially, of that discussion in 2009 was really two things. That the foundation of the relationship between the state and the counties in human services should really be based on performance. We should set clear expectations of what we expect the counties to deliver in delivering human services, hold them accountable for doing that. But the flip side of that and the other piece is, if counties are delivering against those expectations, we should give them the flexibility that they need in order to meet those expectations, those performance measures, without necessarily regard to having a lot of process measures and other kinds of requirements in place, and also without regard to how they structure themselves. So the 2009 law also gave counties more flexibility to think about how they work, both getting flexibility or waivers within individual programs, but also how they structure and work and collaborate with other counties. So those are kind of the pieces that were in that legislation. What the governor is proposing here is really related to the performance piece of that. The 2009 law created a performance steering committee that it gave about 3 years to work on developing a proposal for a performance management system for the state county human services. And the governor is recommending implementation of that system and a recommendation of $1.5 million of administrative support for the department in implementing that system. The Performance Steering Committee met for 3 years. I had the pleasure of being the co-chair of that committee with Tony Carter, Ramsey County Commissioner. And we had a great committee that we worked with over the 3 years. And we put out a report on December 15th of 2012, and you can find that on our website or I think in the reference library now if you want to get into a little bit more depth on this. The basic direction that the Performance Steering Committee suggested is really a system that's focused on continuous improvement, and that is that the state and the counties and our nonprofit partners who we work with need to be working together towards a continuous improvement of improving outcomes for the people we serve. We really tried to stay away from kind of a more gotcha approach of, well, let's figure how we figure out which counties aren't doing well and play gotcha games with them. This is about all of us working together to try to improve outcomes for people. But based on the law that we were working with and on our own discussions, we also understood fundamentally this is also about accountability. And so you will find within the system that there are remedies and corrective action for counties that are not meeting performance expectations as we go forward. And I want to be clear, the committee itself was made up of county folks and DHS folks and nonprofit and advocate folks. So it was kind of a balance of those three groups working together to pull together this recommendation. What the governor's budget is recommending is $1.5 million for the department to essentially carry through our role in supporting this system. The Performance Steering Committee did recommend that that the system needed to have resources backing it in order to be successful. The recommendations also include the creation of a performance committee, which would essentially be, or performance council, I'm sorry, which would essentially be an advisory body to the commissioner on the operation of this system. And we anticipate that would be a very active body that would again represent the way the steering committee was populated by DHS folks, county folks, as well as nonprofit and advocate partners working together. And that was a real key recommendation coming out of the performance steering committee. That group would be staffed by the department, which is part of what we're looking for resources for. The department would also have the role of essentially establishing performance measures and standards for all the programs. The steering committee recommended a first start to get us started, a first set of measures to get us started out. But we recognize that that isn't something you can just put into law and leave there forever. It needs to be a living, ongoing system where you're constantly updating and making changes based on changes in program, changes in funding, changes in direction, what we're learning as we move forward as a system. There also, the recommendation also includes, as I mentioned, remedies for counties that are not meeting performance standards, performance improvement plans, and potentially fiscal penalties if they don't make improvement over a couple-year period. And also requires the commissioner to provide technical assistance to counties, and also peer-to-peer technical assistance, creating the ability for counties to work with each other on how to improve within different programs. Those pieces are supported by the department. The recommendation includes 9 FTEs, some money to build a dashboard for the counties to use as part of managing the performance across our programs, and also some dollars to help with contracting for expertise in measurement or in standard development or in training for counties as we're rolling out the system.
Representative Abler.
Thanks, Don. I'll be brief. I read the preliminary report, and I just encourage you to shoot high on standards, and this shoot's really low. It's only the lowest of the low they're going to be nicked by this, and I think we want to establish ones that are at least at some way toward the baseline. And I, you haven't got time to talk about it now. Will there be a budget item on this in the governor's budget?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abel, yes, there is a budget item. That's what I was just describing, $1.5 million. I think to your question, the committee struggled a little bit with standards and how to set standards. And we kind of came up with a two-standard approach. So there's a high standard that is the standard that we seek in terms of what we want to accomplish as a system, what we're all trying to achieve. And then there's a low standard that is a standard that's kind of, this is the minimum. If you're not meeting this, that's when we kick you into the remedies process. So we tried to get at both issues by having this two-standard approach.
Thanks. And Mr. Chair, I'll just be one more comment. But I think the people who... thank you. Yeah. I think that the people who want to establish minimum standards would be us. I think when the people, and bless the counties, and I'm a fan of the counties and we need them, but when they get to establish their own minimum threshold, it's hard to get consensus on that. We can help them with that consensus and raise the bar a bit and have some really toothy penalties, because at the end of the day, we want them to consolidate their functions and not let small counties who are having, you know, meager outcomes be allowed to continue that. And we want to help them move into better services for all of us. And I know that's all of our interests. So just thought I'd bring that up. Thanks, Mr. Johnson, for your work.
Mr. Johnson, continue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Johnson, you did comment about how this affects us locally, and I just want to say that for me in Rice County this last year, you know, we got behind in our work. We had intake workers with stacks of papers to be processed. And as legislators, I had dozens of phone calls from families who did not get their food service, their paperwork done in a timely manner. I got a call from a physician who had a patient who was in her fourth stage of cancer who couldn't receive the treatment because the money and the papers had not been processed. So our county was four workers behind, and we couldn't afford to hire four. So it took us a year and a half to finally get and find some money to hire two. But in the meantime, you did send down some help on weekends. However, I worry that we'll get back into that same mode again. If we ask our counties to pay too much, and we don't have the tax base to hire as many people as it takes with, you know, because of the recession and the needs of the people that we all want to help. So there is a very big need for our, and this does affect us locally, very much so.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fritz, I agree completely. I think you're raising an issue that we've heard a lot about over the last couple of years, which is just the county's capacity to continue to meet what we're expecting them to do from a financial standpoint, from a finding the right kind of workers to do the work standpoint. And that is a continuing challenge. This proposal doesn't get at that directly, but it's certainly a conversation we bumped up against a lot in our work.
Continue, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'm finished, and so I'll just do a little tee up. Mr. Gray and Mr. Kerber are here to talk about the compliance and Office of Inspector General proposals that we have in our budget. You're aware that Commissioner Jessen 2 years ago created an Office of Inspector General to really try to bring together the pieces of our department, that the current licensing piece, which does a lot of oversight work, with the fraud pieces of our department, which have been scattered in multiple places, to try to get that all into one place to get a real concerted and focused effort on what we're doing, both in the oversight of the providers who deliver services for us, but also what we're doing in terms of detecting and pursuing fraud where we see it. That is Mr. Kerber's job. He's the Inspector General. Mr. Gray, to my immediate right, is our Chief Compliance Officer. And the two of them have worked very closely together on developing proposals to really improve what we're doing in terms of the internal controls that we have within our programs, the oversight of our programs, and the fraud-related work in our programs. And we think it's really important work that we want to continue to move forward with and make somewhat more robust. As we pulled these pieces together, we found out where we have gaps and where we need to do better than what we're doing now, and we want to be able to work on improving that. We think it's incredibly important that our role as an agency to ensure that the dollars are going where they need to go to provide the right service to the right people to meet their needs, and not going places where we're not getting that kind of an outcome, or where there actually may be activity going on that is criminal or otherwise not acceptable. So I'm going to turn it over to Jerry and Greg for the rest of the presentation.
Hey, welcome to the committee, and welcome back to the House of Representatives, Mr. Gray. For those of you that don't know, he's a former member of the House of Representatives.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, my name is Gregory Gray. I'm the Chief Compliance Officer for the Department of Human Services, and of course, to my right here is Jerry Kerber, who's the Inspector General, and he'll speak on some topics relative to OIG. As Chuck just mentioned, you know, we both have, I think, a critical role in terms of program integrity, both the compliance office and OIG. Up until a year and a half ago, the licensing portion that is now a significant portion of OIG was part of the compliance office. Compliance office also includes the legal department, the appeals and regs department, contract and procurement. It includes administrative law, and of course, as I'll talk about today, it includes the internal audit department. Each one of these pieces looks internally within DHS to try and provide a framework of control so that we can avoid errors and avoid fraud. On the other hand, the other side of the coin, so to speak, OIG is out there focusing on fraud that has been committed and then trying to retrieve those funds. So we work hand in hand in many cases. We're trying to avoid things, trying to prevent, trying to add controls, trying to strengthen what we do in DHS so that we're more efficient and more effective. And to the extent that we fail, Jerry's there to kind of make sure that we go after folks who have taken advantage of weaknesses within our system. If you look at the Internal Audit Department itself, currently, and for those of you who are following, we're talking about FAST Fact 65, and I'm on this Governor's Changes, page 24. Currently, we have 3.5 FTEs in the Internal Audit Department for, 11, $12 billion operation. If you look at other agencies, and I might add, of that three and a half, one person is retiring in a month. Another probably will be retiring within the next year or two. So we have an audit department that's aging. We have an audit department that is undersized compared to the load that it's trying to carry. If you look at DOT, they have 8.5 FTEs. If you look at the Department of Health, substantially smaller than us, they have 2 FTEs. DNR has 3. Revenue has 3. So just in comparison to other agencies, we're certainly understaffed. When we look out on the horizon and at some of the audits that we'd like to do, currently we're in kind of a firefighting mode where as things pop up, we go out and we investigate. We want to be far more proactive, and we think that proactive mode is what audit should be about. So if you look at the request, it asks for 5 FTEs, which then kind of puts us about in alignment with what is the Department of Transportation's current FTE capacity, and my understanding is they'll be asking for another 1.2. There are a variety of areas that we've already seen that there are control weaknesses that we have not had the resources to investigate. Some of our grant operations we need to look at more closely. Chuck Johnson just talked about system modernization and the new healthcare exchange. There'll be a variety of system controls as well as program controls surrounding those changes. We need to go in and investigate those on the front end to make sure that we're covering the areas that we need to cover. Having said that, I will leave it at that point and open it up for any questions that you might have.
For Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking on page 65 and the third bullet under, or the second bullet under proposal. Can you talk about it, and I'll just read it, the development of the health insurance exchange and the systems modernization activities will, with significant changes to current process and controls will further strain DHS internal audit capacity. And can you explain how that happens? It seems to me with these, with the modernization and with the exchange, it's hoping to make things run more smoothly and not more slowly and complicate matters. So I just wondered if you could explain the complication, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, as with any change that takes place, there's always an interface of system and people controls that can fall by the wayside. So even though a system may have embedded within it a variety of new edits and software controls that we hope will be functioning and working effectively, we need to be on the front end of looking at that and looking at how they interface with what's happening within those program areas. So at least on the front end, at least as we start gearing up, as we start testing these new systems, it's going to put an additional strain on internal audit to make sure that the controls are actually working and interfacing well with the program controls that are supposed to be in place as well.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gray, I'm wondering, it's my understanding that revenue recapture and penalties and fines go to the general fund. But, you know, there's been some press recently about good work catching providers that are billing for services not provided, you know, other sorts of issues. And I'm wondering if you could give us some projections on potential general fund revenues to anticipate in connection with the addition of additional auditors, because I assume if you have more people looking, you find more problems, and there should be, you know, some consequences.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, my colleague here, Mr. Kerber, will talk a little bit more about some of the actual recapture and the flow of money that overpayments and the like that go back to the general fund. Generally speaking, even though there are occasionally overpayments that we find internally through compliance office and internal audit, generally speaking, we like to try and prevent those things from happening in the first place. So one of the problems we always run into in terms of committee hearings and budget reviews such as this is, you know, they say, how much money are you going to save the budget? And it's difficult for us to really weigh into that because it's hard for us to tell you how much we save in terms of additional efficiencies and in terms of how much was not erroneously spent. Those are things that don't really get listed on a budget. We can look at previous audit reports and tell you about some of the errors that we found. And I'd be more than happy to provide some of those audit reports to this committee. But it's very difficult for us to actually quantify that.
Mr. Gray, do you have as much trouble with Mr. Hoffman as we do? I'm getting the right predictions.
I don't think I have to answer that, Mr. Chair?
Representative Morgan.
Thank you. And just to kind of piggyback on Representative Loeffler's question and your response, you know, I think we want to have the right kinds of safeguards in place, and yet as legislators, we also want to make sure that we're not spending unnecessary money fighting something that might not have a return on the investment. And having said that, it's also because it's so few people, the tendency to come forward and say, you know, excuse me, I haven't found enough fraud to warrant my salary probably isn't going to happen. And so we're asking kind of that bigger picture, and I think looking back is a fine way to do that. Mm-hmm. To look at history and say, we put these people in place, here's the work we did, and looking at last year, it's hard to predict moving forward, but you can look back and give us some assurance that the number of staff is appropriate, that the return on the investment, if you will, even though that's not generally thought of in the kind of audit sense we're thinking of, is appropriate. And so I would just hope that as we move forward, rather than continually spending more, that we make certain that what we're spending is wisely spent. And thank you.
Mr. Gray.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you're absolutely right. And again, as I said, I'm more than happy to provide you with kind of a historical perspective of some of the I can't say recoveries, but some of the control weaknesses that resulted in losses to the agency. And as I said in my introduction, in particular in terms of some of our grants, our grant programs, we found that, you know, there have been times when those grant funds have been misused. And we can certainly quantify that. And the fact that Mr. Kerber is in business again points to the fact that we haven't done nearly enough in terms of preventative controls.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Jerry Kerber from the Inspector General's Office. And I might just add that one of the things that we are working together on is taking the results of our investigations of overpayment situations, some of which may be fraud, and doing a review of where in the process did the controls break down that allowed that to happen. And so where we are looking at, we think this is where the control system broke down, then we can hand that over to our internal audits folks for a much closer review to see, was this a one-time issue, or is this in fact something that can happen frequently and does happen frequently? And so we're really kind of really tied together on these actions, and I'm confident that we'll be able to give his staff enough business so that we can kind of maybe report back in the future on what are some of the results of those kinds of referrals.
Mr. Gray.
Mr. Chairman, I would also add that fits into a larger enterprise risk management process that we have at DHS, whereby we funnel some of these problems, whether they come from investigations by OIG or from our internal audit reports. Those errors or weaknesses are analyzed and prioritized and used as a mechanism to then go out and do audits and determine whether or not we need additional internal control. So we're trying to make this a very systematic process so that we utilize the resources we have most as effectively as we possibly can.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Mr. Gerber, can you give a few examples? Is it institutions or individuals where you've discovered fraud? You don't have to name names, but I mean just dollar amounts.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, we could get into that detail. I'd have to probably call one of my colleagues up here for some good examples. I think the range is from small to very large in overpayment issues. There are a number of schemes that we uncover from time to time, providing services to, you know, billing for services that are not provided. We see those things, and we seek the recoveries. And I'll talk a little bit about how we want to kind of expand our authority to do that in some of our proposals. But for actual examples, maybe we can get some actual examples for the committee. To either to present or written descriptions, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Gray, but then where's that in?
Mr. Chairman, that's all I have, and I would turn this over to my colleague, Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Kerber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Jerry Kerber from the Inspector General's Office. And I think you've sort of gotten an overview of the Inspector General's Office itself. It was created about a year and a half ago, a little less than that. And it's made up of two divisions. One is the licensing division that licenses, you know, 24,000 programs throughout the state, child care, adult foster care, mental health programs, chemical dependency treatment programs, a variety of services, all services for people with developmental disabilities. The other half of the other leg of this office is the Financial Fraud and Abuse Investigation Division. And that was made up of pulling together the fraud investigative activities from various areas of our agency, Minnesota Care Fraud, CSRS unit that investigates Medicaid fraud by providers, Medicaid fraud and overpayment. So I have to make sure I say the overpayment thing. It's not always fraud. And then also the oversight and contracts we have with county investigators who are looking into recipient overpayment issues. And so that kind of is a makeup of our office. And What we have, I have seven new initiatives here to go through quickly, and I'll start with the ones that are related to our program integrity or reduction of fraud. And it's important, I think, to look at all four of them together, because in total, I think Representative Norton's comment about return on investment is something we talk about. And for these four proposals, we're seeking, we believe that after the first biennium, we'll recover about a little over $500,000 more than it's costing to do this work. And then in the second biennium, it's going to be over $1 million. And we're seeking to build an infrastructure, really, following some of last year's legislative changes that we were successful at. But we're going to be a better built machine to deal with reports of overpayments and fraud that come into us.
So Representative Dean has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm going to wait for Mr. Kerber to complete his testimony.
Okay. Thank you. The first one that I'll talk about here is your Fast Fact 61, and it's on page 23 of the governor's change summary. And it's the provider screening and application fee. And what this relates to is a requirement in the Affordable Care Act that we're not in compliance with now. That requires a pre- and post-enrollment visit of providers who are determined through their process, through the Affordable Care Act system, of they're determined to be either medium or high-risk providers, high risk of fraud. And so those types of programs, before they enroll in the Medicaid reimbursement program, medical assistance reimbursement, they need to be visited, and then shortly thereafter they're enrolled, they also need to be visited. And there's a fee, an enrollment fee that's required, that's set in by the federal government, that right now is $536. That fee, however, is only to be collected from providers who are brand new. It's not a re-enrollment fee. And if somebody is kind of re-upping, it's not a new fee for that. If they're already enrolled, they don't ever pay a fee. If they have enrolled in another state, they can't pay a fee to Minnesota. And if they're Medicare certified, they don't pay a fee. So we're talking about a narrow group of people that providers that are going to have to pay this new enrollment fee. But what that fee is intended to cover is that pre- and post-enrollment site visit that I mentioned. It also is going to cover some of our costs for checking various licensing databases to make sure people are properly credentialed, and then also doing an FBI, fingerprint-based FBI record check on the owners and managerial officials of the high-risk providers. And so the fees that we're going to be collecting for that aren't quite enough, and so that's why we're seeking a supplement for that activity from the general fund. When we go to calculating what's going to be the return on this kind of this kind of activity, for the pre-enrollment visits, we're not really able to sort of book any kind of savings on that or identify any. What might happen is we're going to find that provider may not actually be equipped to get started in business, or they may not have the credentials, they may not really have a building, they might not have what they really need to get going, and so they won't be enrolled. And so those recipients of services will actually then get their care from another provider. And so it may not be actually a savings of any kind, it's just that provider won't be available. However, when we get to the post-enrollment visits, that's where we anticipate, based on history of doing fraud investigations, that we may discover a number of billing problems that providers have, and we anticipate that in 10% of those cases, we'll be making a referral over to our CSRS investigators to do a full investigation.
Can you tell us what page you're on and the Fast Facts?
Mr. Chair, the Fast Facts is number 61. And in the governor's summary, it's on page 23.
Continue, Mr. Kerber.
So What that leads to then is the second proposal. So when we do these site visits, we're going to be discovering situations that need a more thorough investigation of possible overpayment problems with the provider. And so the second proposal is to expand our CSRS unit. CSRS is the group within DHS, been around for a long time, and they investigate overpayment issues with Medicaid providers. There are currently 800,000 people receiving services through our Minnesota healthcare programs. There's 154,000 healthcare providers who are enrolled, and there's 78 different types of those providers. But we currently have 10 investigators to look into those, and so it's not really adequate. And especially if we're going to be making additional referrals through this, the provider enrollment, post-enrollment screening process. So we're seeking here to add about 6 investigators. The current investigator on average recovers about $500,000 a year in actual overpayments, and that's not identified as actual recoveries. So it's a good investment to get more fraud investigators.
Mr. Kerber, at one time, 3 or 4 years ago, the feds were going to also reward us if we collected found fraud. Is that still in place or not?
Mr. Chair, there's when we identify overpayments, and that kind of leads right next to the next one, the recovery part of this. If we identify an overpayment, we have to give half of it to the feds because half of it was their money. And we give it to them at the time that we identify it. And I'm not sure what you're talking about, but it might be this issue where one of the things that we're not very good at doing here is if a provider is continuing in business and we discover an overpayment, we can usually get the funds back. We get it back through some kind of a settlement agreement where they pay it back as a scheduled repayment, or we can recoup funds by withholding a certain portion of the future payments to them. When a provider goes out of business, however, we have some difficulty getting that money because they're not there. One of the things that we're proposing to do here in the third item here Fast Fact number 56. It's kind of fun too, I guess. It's on page 25 of the summary. This might be getting to your issue, Mr. Chair. If we find that we're unable to actually recover the funds, we are able then to ask for that money back from the feds. And we haven't been doing that. In fact, we have never done it. And so we have, in many cases, paid our 50% back to the feds because we identified an overpayment. But then we've been unable to collect it on the back end, and we haven't gone back to the feds to get that 50% back. So that's one of the things we're proposing to do with this. Another one that we're proposing is related to the surety bonds. And the surety bonds, we currently have surety bond requirements for personal care provider organizations and for durable medical equipment providers. The personal care provider, we've collected on two of those. The requirements have been in place for a long time, but it wasn't until last year that we actually started going after a surety bond for a provider who went away after we identified an overpayment. And so what we want to do is make a couple changes to those surety bond requirements. In the one case, for durable medical equipment providers, we want to make sure that we're identified at DHS as an obligee of the bond. Currently, they're required to only identify the federal government for purposes of Medicare, so we want to expand that. The other issue with the personal care provider organizations is we want to raise it. It's only $50,000 at this point. We want to raise it to $100,000. But then the third one we want to make referrals, increase our referrals to the Department of Revenue Collections Unit to get money back when we have a provider that goes out of business. But Mr. Chair, getting back to your question, there's an opportunity to keep more of the federal share if there is, it's a 10% increase of the federal share If it's a payment being made relative to the False Claims Act, and so if there's a False Claims Act initiative, and it's found to there's a relator who has brought this forward, and in the end it's found to be valid, and there's an overpayment, and that we're going to be getting money back as a result of that, we can get an extra 10%. We can keep another 10% of that federal share if our state False Claims Act complies or comports with the federal False Claims Act. And so our Minnesota False Claims Act has been found to not be adequate in that area, but Representative Simon has introduced a bill that's going to make it. And so we've been working with him on that issue to make sure that that Minnesota False Claims Act does comport with the federal False Claims Act adequately so that we can keep another 10% of that. I think there's a long-winded answer to your question, Mr. Chair. Was that what you were thinking?
Precise answer that I got. I knew it was Representative Simon.
Okay.
Taken some initiative on this 3 or 4 years ago.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and the bill was introduced the other day too. So, and we'll be working with him on that. The fourth area of the program integrity area relates to child care assistance, and there's going to be like $418 million spent on child care assistance through the child care assistance program in this biennium. And in the next biennium, and there's 12,500 providers who are enrolled, and there's more than 19,000 families. Also, however, in November of 2012, there were 6,178 families on the waiting list, on the basic sliding fee waiting list. We have seen from the licensing end of the work in monitoring child care programs, we've certainly seen over the years what we have suspected to be some overbilling issues, and perhaps overbilling related to kids who were not actually getting services. But there really, strangely, hasn't been any administrative agency in place to investigate that. If there's a recipient issue, somebody has maybe not been accurate with their eligibility, we have, as I mentioned earlier, the county staff, the county investigators who look at eligibility issues and misrepresentations there. However, when it comes to providers who are possibly overbilling, and in this case for children they're not really serving, there hasn't been anybody to investigate this. In some cases, what we've tried to do is to get a criminal investigation to occur, and that's kind of the success with that effort has varied around the state and with different county attorneys, different law enforcement agencies. So what we're proposing here is that, you know, that we want to fill this enormous gap by creating an investigation unit that will actually investigate some of these cases where we have reason to believe the child care provider is involved in some overbilling issues with child care assistance program. And so in that case, we're also seeing, we're predicting some savings, not the first biennium, but the second biennium. The first biennium, it's going to cost, we believe, $358,000. But in some of that will be recovered funds, but that's the total net cost. In the second biennium, we expect to be recovering an additional $229,000. And there was an error to that extent on the spreadsheet that you had that we'll be correcting in the next iteration. So those are the program integrity proposals. And, Mr. Chair, if there's any more questions about any of those.
Well, one of my questions is, you know, there's some people who are just doing outright fraud and overbilling in the millions of dollars. And it always shows up in the paper, so we pay attention to it. It'd be nice for us to have an estimate of what percentage of these kind of providers do you think are doing this? You know, is it half of a percent or is it 50% are basically committing fraud? And I have no idea. You just read one case and you don't know if that was the really unusual one or if there's a whole bunch of that going on.
Mr. Chair, I understand your question. I agree. What we end up doing is sort of chasing the report that came to us, where somebody had some reason to believe that there was something going on, and then that's oftentimes what triggers us. What we're hoping with a couple extra fraud investigators here, the six, is that we're going to be able to follow some of our own data analytics a little bit more. So we do some of that now, where if we have a case that shows, pretty remarkable overpayments were made through a particular scheme, what we're trying to do is go back and look at other cases and look for some outliers in the data. But we're not doing that as much as we would like to. Still, what we're doing mainly is following up on reports that have been brought to us. And so it's hard to know that. It's hard to generalize, well, what sampling is that of all? I mean, because we're responding to what's been reported to us, so we don't know, where is it not being reported to us? I think we can only try and get better in that way over time.
We have a couple of questions that we're getting close to running out of time. Representative Dean, did you want to wait till later, or do you want to do it now?
It has to do with the program integrity, so I better get them while I got them here. So, Mr. Kerber, thank you for the testimony. One of the things that we had looked at in the last couple of years is RFPs from outside groups to overlay on our billing system to look for waste, fraud, and abuse, but particularly fraud with billing. And with some of the outside vendors looking at it that have done this in other states, had large collections in doing that. When they were looking at our systems, they found some weaknesses with that. For example, in other states, they had very simple things. Billing for hospice services after somebody had died. You double-check the date of death certificate with the last date of services. Billing Medicaid and Medicaid for the same service. Billing frontline drug and delivering generics. Mm-hmm. And those systems checks that they could overlay over systems could collect money. They were offering those services. DHS then testified, well, we're working on that. We've got many of those systems in place. Now we're hearing that we've got a systems upgrade with respect to our software systems. Can you talk a little bit about how those are being addressed within the existing systems, and then also how the department is looking at working with outside vendors for billing, oversight, and collection and repayment of money?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, yes, there has been that conversation has been going on. And in fact, I believe it was 2 years ago that legislation passed that allowed the department to enter into those kinds of contracts. The governor's office had an initiative at the same time where we sought data analytics organizations to get on the state contract. And there are a number of those organizations that are now on the state contract, and we can then enter into work agreements with them to do this kind of work. In one case, we call them RAC contracts. They're recovery audit, I can't remember the C part, contract, recovery audit contracts. And so that's the post payment end of things. And we have one of those that's just about ready to start up now. And what's interesting about these is they will be working on reviewing the payments that we've made, and we'll be selecting a particular provider type that will assist them, will provide them the data they need to do the analytics. But our payment to them is a percentage of actual recoveries. So there's no real cost to the general fund, and there's no cost unless there's some return on their efforts. Similarly, there's a prepayment contract that's being negotiated right now that's going to be doing a lot of the very thing you mentioned, Representative Dean, about taking a look at our system to see what kinds of common errors may be permitted through our system. I think from what I've heard so far is that our system is a lot tighter than many states, and some of the examples you gave, I mean, every one of our claims is checked against a list of people who are deceased. That we have a lot of those things that are built in already. But at any rate, we're also kind of negotiating a contract, and that would be through our healthcare area, with the data analytics company to look at the system itself and identify those areas. And then they, too, will get paid actual out-of-recoveries that result from their findings. And so those, there are two efforts underway. And I can get more information about those, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dean, if you like, too.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kerber, I appreciate that. And also, if we maybe could just follow up with me or the committee on what we asked you to do in terms of reporting for new hires and for collections. I don't recall off the top of my head what that is, but if you could get that back to the committee on what we asked you to report back to us, just to see how it's shaken down. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I know we don't have a lot of time, but Mr. Kerber, I'm just, excuse me if I missed this, but could you just kind of tell us, generally speaking, who are providers that would be considered moderate or high risk? What kind of providers are you talking about there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the high-risk providers that have been identified are home care providers, personal care provider organizations, durable medical equipment, PCAs. No? Yeah? Those are the ones that I'm... Is that about right? I'm looking over to my colleague, Ricky Coonerth, who has been involved in this more. But it's that kind of provider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Kerber, you're talking about sort of a category of services. You're not talking about some particular characteristics of certain providers that you're worried about then. Am I getting that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, that's correct. You're correct in that providers will be identified by the federal government system to be low, medium, or high risk. And those high-risk providers, categorically, will need, and we can get you a list of those because it is defined. Those high-risk providers will need a fingerprint-based FBI record check on all the owners and managerial officials, and then the high and the medium risk will need pre- and post-site inspections relative to pre- and post-enrollment site inspections.
Thank you.
Representative, the one that was in the paper most recently, it was a home care provider that was providing health care within the home, and he billed for services that were never provided at all. And in other cases, he said, well, we sent an RN over there, and well, they took somebody that didn't have much training at all, but he billed at the RN rate. And so those kinds of things are really subject to, not certainly not all the people that provide those services have done something intentionally wrong, but those kinds of things we need to look at.
Right.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I absolutely hear what you say, and I absolutely agree. We need to weed out this kind of fraud, no question about it, and I'm glad we're doing better and better at trying to do that, but really my concern was more what singles somebody out to have to go get a background check and fingerprints as opposed to somebody else who doesn't have to do that. And if it's categories where it's easier to, where we're more dependent on the good faith and honesty of the provider because there are so many of these and we don't have the ability to, you know, I can see that. I just wondered if it was, you know, within home care providers, for example, if something made somebody high risk as opposed to somebody else. I, you know, just kind of wanted to understand that better because we're getting a lot more particular and even intrusive with some of these providers than we have been in the past. So I just wanted to make sure that I understood who was being singled out for this increased scrutiny.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I can get you a list of which providers are singled out, but I think it's historically the providers that have been more associated with overpayments and fraudulent activity, historically nationwide. In some of these cases, I think it's the very thing you mentioned, though, you know, if you look at PCA services, they're provided in a very private setting with no supervision. There's a lot of dependence on the honesty of the provider in those cases to actually be showing up and providing that service. We have a system where the recipient is expected to sign a timesheet, but we've certainly heard from recipients where sometimes they're asked to sign a whole stack of timesheets and then they're filled out later by the employee, by the PCA themselves, who turn it into the employer. And the billing occurs, and in some cases maybe the recipient knew or didn't know what they were participating, but maybe they got a couple hundred dollars a week for groceries, and they were perfectly happy with the arrangement. And so there's all kinds of things. Other things we've seen is where in investigating a personal care provider organization on site, we discovered that in looking a little bit more closely, all of the employees that we've done background studies on seem to live at the same address, and it's upstairs from the office. And then also when we look at where the recipients live who are getting care, oh, it's also upstairs. And so some of these things are, you know, when you take a closer look on site and you're looking at the records a little more closely, some of these things jump out a little bit more than they do, you know, unless just by the nature of the computer system running the payments.
You know, and not all of it's intentional fraud. There are some people that just aren't very good at running a business. They don't have the training to know how to do this, and they make mistakes.
Mr. Chair, of course, and you know, and I have to be careful because where we come from, we're looking at only the fraudulent activities, but there are wonderful services provided out there, and people depend on these services to remain independent in their own homes, and we need these services. The issue is, we need the money that's available for these services to go to the right people, so they actually are supporting people living independently.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and actually it's a good day to have a little extended time. I don't have a lot of questions, but I've tried to keep minimum. But on this this $536 fee for new providers, is that just the kind you listed, or is that every new little medical doctor and chiropractor also going to be getting these fees?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, that's going to be everybody. So the fee is on everybody who enrolls. There's an exclusion for some independent practitioners. Is it all independent practitioners? Okay, so independent practitioners will not pay the fee, but it's other providers will. But it's new ones. If you're currently in the system, there's no fee.
And we're always happy to, you know, charge someone else a fee. So I'm for that, you know. But I just want to, this will be a budget proposal, I'm sure, and you and I have talked a fair amount. But I, on some of these providers, this is certainly going to be a burden. And in the in the fee-for-service side, if that's who's going to be charged, some of these clinicians get very little of any fee-for-service business. And so they want to be available, but it's at some point it's going to not be a break-even proposal. So as these, you know, with this other 245 B and D changes and those licensing things and these fees, you know, I'm just aware of what it might burden. And so, and maybe, you know, if you, so the existing providers don't have to be checked at all, Mr. Kerber, is that right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, the existing providers don't have to pay the fee, but the existing providers won't get the post-enrollment. They obviously won't get a pre-enrollment visit, and they also, I think we have to do one post-enrollment visit for the existing providers. You know, there's some stuff here we have to figure out, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, to be honest. I'm not sure.
So we'll call us our worker. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. Sorry, I keep forgetting. So it's kind of a work in progress?
Yes, Mr. Kerber.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kerber, I'm wondering to what degree, maybe this is a question for Mr. Gray, but, you know, to what degree we engage the recipients of these services into being part of the checks and balances of this, because, you know, the families have won the chance to be on the basic sliding scale support. Many of them have been on it, the waiting list, for years. I mean, they know how precious that is. And, you know, I would think if you sent them out a postcard and said, we just want you to confirm that you're receiving this many hours per week, they would be glad to fill that out if they, you know, understood that that was to continue. And if some provider is saying the children were there for 60 hours and they were really there only for 45, you know, it seems like you can engage the people who are beneficiaries of this without having to hire investigators going out on site or, you know, those sorts of things. I mean, it might tick you as to which ones to send an investigator. And I also am struck by the fact that the high-risk providers that you've identified are all the very low-wage providers of services, personal services that make $10 to $15 an hour. And I'm hoping that we are equally going after the surgeon, the dentist who could say he gave grandma new dentures and we don't know whether he did or didn't. And, you know, the people who bill at very large scale amounts may be just as tempted to do bad things in order to increase their bottom line. We hear a lot from highly paid providers about how they don't earn enough money in our payment scales under MA, and that may create a temptation. And so I'd just really like to understand how we balance that out. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, we do find overbilling issues among the other providers, too, that are beyond the PCAs and home care providers. And, in fact, that's really where we get our biggest recoveries. When I mentioned that the average is about $500,000 a year return on each CSRS investigator we have, it's really through those types of investigations where we get the big money. If we're identifying overpayments by a small personal care provider organization, and you know, for personal care services that are provided by a low-wage employee, and then after we identify it, the program goes away, that's not where we're getting the return on the investment here. What we're getting it on is on those providers, and we are doing that. Dental care, eyeglasses, there are a number of those investigations we do every year.
And then, Mr. Chair, my first question is about to what degree do we engage the... Mm-hmm. The recipients in helping us mm-hmm. check whether billings are appropriate.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, sure. I think that's a great idea, and I think you know, I think we, as we were starting our thinking about this new investigative unit, we kind of have a lot of referrals already, but I think that's a sort of a good quality assurance mechanism, that especially if providers are going to know that we're going to be doing that kind of surveying of their current families that they're serving, to asking the family to verify that these are the hours of service that they're getting. I'm hoping that would be preventative, is also triggering, but I like that idea, and I think we'll pursue that.
Okay. Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, members, I have three proposals that are in the licensing area, I can be quick or detailed on these. One of them, I think you heard some discussion of already from Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman, related to the home and community-based services redesign of that system, where under the various waivers, only one waiver service has been historically licensed by the department, and that's the DD waiver, Services for People with Developmental Disabilities. Since the very early 90s, we have licensed those services. However, the services provided under CADI or CAC or TBI waivers, those have not been licensed. In 2007, the department was audited and found to be out of compliance with federal expectations regarding the consistency of expectations of providers, the payments, the oversight. There was a lot of variability throughout the state, really dependent that was a result of county contracting that identified how much service would be provided and what would be the rates provided for that service. And then the monitoring, of course, differed considerably from DD waiver services that were licensed and all the other services that were not. And so what the department has been working on now for a couple of years is a new way to oversee these kinds of services. And last year, what passed was the first version, or the first level of what we refer to as 245D. So it's a new chapter in, you know, next to our licensing statute that identifies standards for these waiver providers. And it's going to be a single set, and this year we'll propose the other half of it. These are going to be one single set of standards that apply across all the waivers, which is something that providers have been asking for a long time, not having different standards depending on what pot of money the funding is coming from. And it's also going to allow for other things that providers have asked for, like a single license that will apply statewide. And so we'll have language to set up that whole new system. This part of it is going to be related to the fees. Our licensing activities since 2011 are now funded through our recovery of licensing fees. Up until 2011, we had a portion was paid out of a general fund appropriation, all of our expenses were paid out of a general fund appropriation. Some of it was recovered through a fee that was less than the appropriation. But as of 2011, now the fees are designed to cover our entire costs. So there's no general fund appropriation to the licensing division for this activity. And so with this new system, that means, of course, then that our fees are going to have to recover the actual cost for doing this work. And so that's what you're going to see in the language in the bill, are those fees that we're going to set out. The next one I'll talk about is the there's a background study proposal that we're going to be having, and there's one of the proposals on the spread. Let's see, it's on the summary sheet that's not right. It got in there by mistake. But this is fast fact number 55, and there's two of them labeled 55. What we're doing here is the department requested and received a federal grant to enhance our background study system. Ultimately, the goal is that all background studies that we do on people who work in long-term care initially, and then it'll expand out, will be fingerprint based, and they'll include an FBI record check. That's the condition of the grant, that we have to be working towards that. There are a number of other provisions in there that when we start doing background studies in that way, they're going to be much more expensive than they are now, because the FBI charges us about $22 per background study. And so what we have to do is to figure out a way that we're going to not repeat so many background studies on individuals. People who work in healthcare and human services are often very mobile, and we can see that in our background study system, that it's unusual for us really to do a single background study on somebody for one employer. People move around an awful lot. And so we don't want to be charging whatever the fee is that we ultimately arrive at for these new expanded background studies that include the FBI. We don't want to be repeating those in all those cases. So one of the things that we have to do, and we've talked about this over a number of years, is to have a better connection with the criminal justice information system. And so over the years, there have been enhancements to MINSIS, Minnesota Court Information System. And so what we're proposing here is that we will simply subscribe to a service from them. So we'll get new criminal history information, even on a daily basis, and then we'll filter out all the information that's about people that we don't care about. And we don't care about them because they're not somebody we've done a background study on, and they're not currently affiliated with a licensed program somewhere or a personal care provider organization. So this one of the proposals is to do that. And it's not going to cost any money because it's being funded through the federal grant. So it's costing us about $10,000 to do the software, but it's the funding for it is taken care of through the grant. But it's ending up in the budget bill here because there were so many questions about, well, isn't this going to cost money? And yes, it is. So it's got zeros by it. The next thing we want to do is to expand our background study at the BCA to also include the Predatory Offender Registry. And this is not going to cost us any additional, the BCA will not charge us any additional fee for getting this additional information. But the Predatory Offender Registry is what's called in many states a sex offender registry. And this is another requirement that we access this kind of information for a federal grant, but it's also been a good idea to do for quite some time. Now, if somebody, our Minnesota Predatory Offender Registry has a different name than Sex Offender Registry, because there's a few other people that get a spot on the list. And so kidnapping and some kind of domestic assaults and stalking will get you, will earn you a spot on the Predatory Offender Registry. Those crimes also, of course, are disqualifiers under our background study law, but if somebody committed the offense in another state and moved to Minnesota, and they haven't committed a crime in Minnesota, when we simply check with the BCA to see if they have a disqualifying criminal history, they're going to have a clean record in Minnesota. So we won't know anything about the fact that they committed sex crimes in Tennessee, and they're actually appropriately registered in Minnesota on the Predatory Offender Registry. So we want to start getting access to that information. Wisconsin, a couple years ago, the Wisconsin Legislative Auditors Bureau did an analysis and compared their list of registered sex offenders with their list of family child care providers. And, of course, they found that they were issuing family child care licenses to some homes where there was a registered sex offender. In Illinois, they recently did the same thing. We want to get ahead of that just a little bit so that that doesn't happen. So that's our second one. But again, that's going to be funded through the extra work that's involved will be funded through the grant. And then the last one.
This is, yeah. Maybe it's, I don't understand this right, but you're talking about just the licensing. And previously we've been talking about financial fraud. Does your group deal with abuse of the people who are being treated, or is that something else?
Mr. Chair, yes. I did shift gears here to start talking about the licensing initiatives. And in the licensing division, we not only license services, but we investigate alleged abuse and neglect of vulnerable adults and children, and we do background studies. And so there's like those three functions within the licensing division.
So again, there's an awful case in the newspaper in the last month about an adult foster care provider that was doing something awful with the person she was supposed to be taking care of.
Right, Mr. Chair. Yes, it's true. You know, whenever those cases come up, the first thing, of course, we look at is, you know, did we do the background study as required, and was there something we missed?
In this particular case, there was a background problem.
There was a background study, and you're saying in that case there was a background of inappropriate behavior, yeah. Then. I'm going to look into that part, Mr. Chair. I wasn't aware of that part of it. I will. Yeah.
It was... foster care person was taking this 19-year-old, developmentally disabled, yeah, woman out for prostitution.
Right.
And whoever the foster care, she had something previous to that in her background.
I'm going to check into that, Mr. Chair. Certainly, after the fact, that we have all the tools to make sure the person doesn't work in a setting like that anymore. But ideally, the background studies are to be preventative in nature, and we would prevent that kind of thing from happening. So I will check into that. The last proposal we have is related to the family child care licensing standards in follow-up to the, you probably heard about the infant mortality review panel recommendations for changes to family child care. And Mr. Chair, we have, this really began for us in 2011, the end of 2011. Commissioner Jessen asked if we would do a year-end report that identified any trends in licensing. And what we tend to do in licensing, unfortunately, is look at every tree by itself, and we don't often step back and look at the forest. And that was pretty enlightening to do that on that occasion. What we discovered is that we had been issuing more licensing sanctions in family child care related to infant deaths than we had realized. And as we looked at it further, we could see that it had doubled in the last 5 years compared to the previous 5 years. The numbers were... So in like from 2002 to 2006, there had been 25 deaths that had resulted in a sanction. And then 2007 to 2011, there had been 49. So we went from 25 to 49. And so we started looking at these a little bit closer, and already in 2012, there were 9. In the first 6 months of 2012, there were 9 deaths. And so what seemed to jump out at us is the fact that, 75% of these deaths were associated with an unsafe sleep practice by the provider. 75% of them, or 60, there were 65 of these deaths were of infants in an unsafe sleep situation. Some were very clearly the result of that unsafe sleep situation. Some were very clearly an infant found in a crib with its face in a pillow. Others, infant found in the crib on its stomach with its face in the buried in the mattress where it couldn't breathe. Another was one where an infant was found in a car seat strapped in and had choked on the strap. There are many, many examples of these cases, and so some are very obviously a result of that, but others were still nonetheless a safe sleep violation, and so we decided to take a closer look at this, and we asked the Child Mortality Review Panel to also take a look. The Child Mortality Review Panel is a group of people that meets quarterly, established in statute, to review child deaths that have occurred. If the deaths occur in a licensed program, or if the deaths are somehow thought by the county to be related to child maltreatment, or if it's involving a death of a child that is involved, where the family is involved in the child protection system. So that review panel takes a look at those deaths on an individual basis. And so when we realized the frequency had been increasing, we asked them to go back and take a look collectively at these deaths and come forth, if they could, with some recommendations for changes that we could pursue. We've had a lot of discussion since then with providers, and a lot of discussion with parents. The commissioner and I met with a young couple whose infant died on the eighth day of family child care, found with his face in a pillow that shouldn't have been in the crib. We've gotten a lot of feedback, and I'm sure you've heard by email and phone call from many of the people I have heard from, who oftentimes are family child care providers, who have read that list of recommendations and have identified how those recommendations would put them out of business. Certainly, we recognize that family child care is an essential component to our fabric of Minnesota, and so many people rely on it. In fact, on any given day, there are 90,000 kids in family child care, which is important to think about, because there are about 60,000 kids in child care centers. And so there's 1.5 times as many kids getting care in family child care as there are in child care centers. Yet the incidence of death was 28 times as many. So we, during that same period, we had 28 times as many kids that died in family child care. So something about family child care made this different for us. So that's where we really focused. But I want the committee to understand that we didn't take necessarily just those recommendations from the mortality review panel and put those in a bill, in bill language. What you're going to see is really the result of our reviewing those recommendations with stakeholder groups. We met in St. Cloud, we met in Rochester, we met in St. Paul with family child care providers, and as I mentioned, with parents of kids in care, and even with some parents of kids who are deceased. And we came back, I think, with a pretty reasonable set of changes to the child care system. I'll be really quick. There were some common themes in this whole process, and certainly one of them was that there was inconsistent enforcement. There was inconsistent interpretation of what was expected. Provider A and Provider B next to each other, if they had a different licensor coming to visit them, they might get different explanations of what they're supposed to be. The same provider might get different explanations over time if they had a change in their licensing staff. What we found is that, we stopped doing training of new licensors, new county licensors. The state used to provide training to new licensors, but we had to stop due to, budget reductions. And so we want to reinstate that training. And we want to really go a long way towards getting at the compliance of providers through better communication to them about what the expectations are and through more consistent enforcement. So we will be increasing, or we're proposing to increase, the number of training hours for providers. You may have heard that the report recommended 24 hours a year. We're going to be recommending 16 hours a year. And not because 16 was a magic number, but it was because we looked instead at what kind of training would be good for providers to have on an annual basis, and what did that amount to. And it came out to about 16 hours a year. And so that's going to be one of our recommendations. And we're recommending some of the schedules change a little bit. Some of the training was required every 5 years for SIDS and shaken baby training. We're asking that be moved up to annually. And some of the other first aid training that also had been every 5 years, we're moving that to every 2 years. Those kinds of training increases, what we've heard from providers is that they're not necessarily opposed to those, as long as the training is available. And so we heard a lot about the variability of training availability throughout the state. In the metro area, there's lots of training available. When you get out to greater Minnesota, it isn't. And so that's part of our proposal, too, is to make sure the training is equally available throughout the state, and there are also grants to help pay for that training. So it's kind of a comprehensive approach. there are some changes for providers that you may hear about, and one is that we are asking that providers check on a sleeping infant every 15 minutes for the first 30 days, for the first 4 weeks of enrollment in a provider's home, and also if the infant has respiratory issues. Most of the infants that had died, sadly, was in that first 4 weeks of care, and so we're thinking that, you know, this would be a reasonable thing. Child care centers check on infants at least every 15 minutes, and so we want to do that for family child care too, but thereafter it's every 30 minutes. We'll have some language in there asking that providers always have a monitor. If they're not continuously supervising an infant, they should be monitoring them. And that's another requirement that's in child care centers. One more that will be somewhat controversial probably is that we want to require that providers have liability insurance. Right now, family child care providers are expected to have liability insurance, but if they don't, they're expected to, but if they don't, is the way the regulations say, then they need to inform the parents, and they need to inform the parents in writing and get a sign-off from the parents. Sadly, in more than one of these infant death cases, the parents thought that there was liability insurance and only found out after the fact that there wasn't. But the purpose of these is really to enhance compliance. And so the compliance angle of this argument for liability insurance is that it's similar to automobile insurance, in that my insurance company pays attention to my driving record. They pay attention to my tickets and my accidents. And it's because I don't want them to see that I have tickets and accidents that I drive more carefully. And so what we're thinking here with this is that this will be another enhancer to the motivation to use the proper safe sleep techniques. That's why we're proposing this one. And Mr. Chair, I think I'll stop there for any questions.
Okay, any last questions? We got about 30 seconds. Thank you, Mr. Kerber, and very interesting presentation. You're doing a very good job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
With that, the